Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Okay, raise your hand if you've had an affair. It's really okay because this is radio. We can't see you. Well, some 40% of marriages are rocked by affairs every year, but few really want to admit it. And this is an important topic, and that's why Dr. Scott Holtzman, the author of The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity, is back with us for part two. He was on this program April 22nd, so for continuity, you may want to listen to that archived show if you haven't already. Welcome to this program, Dr. Scott. How are you? Hello, Scott. Okay, he's not there quite yet. I know he'll be there, so I will just punt a little and let you know that it's my birthday today, and I'm really happy to have a birthday and to have my life be going so well. My life is really full of gratitude, and in fact, just a couple of days ago, my man of 3.5 years proposed marriage, so I'm newly engaged. I have a ring on my finger. And Melissa may be listening to this, so please let me know when Dr. Scott is on the line, because we need him to talk about this program. He has many books. I'll introduce him, and that'll take a little time, and then maybe he'll be on the line. He is one of the country's foremost experts on infidelity and marriage, and he is the author of The Secrets of Happily Married Men, The Secrets of Happily Married Women, and The Secrets of Happy Families. So he's a real expert about happy marriages and happy families, and then what happens if there is an affair.
Hey, Diana.
Hey, there you are. I was just introducing you, so I'm really glad you're here, because it's going to make it a much better program.
You know, I'm one of those people that likes to come to the party just a couple minutes before after everybody else gets there, so that I can make my grand entrance.
And then you get a little more attention, Scott.
You're calling me out, Diana, already.
I am so grateful you're here. I've been known to improvise, but thank goodness you're here. So I've introduced you and encouraged people to listen to our part one show together, which was April 22nd. So today we're going to look at the steps to ending an affair, some of the principles of apology, some guidelines for recovery. This is a really tough one for lots of couples. And the one rule to a happy marriage. Now, you say there's one rule. I think there's more than one rule, but we'll talk about it.
Well, you know how those things go. By the time I'm done explaining that one rule, it opens up to a whole bunch of possibilities. So let's make sure we save time for that. We'll try not to digress too much.
No, yes. And in fact, I'll hopscotch over the others if we haven't gotten to it by the end of this program. So
Sounds good. Let's be
sure that we do it. So this book of yours is excellent, The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity, and very well written, very well organized, very readable. And I'm looking at your book and breaking it off, How to Say Goodbye. And this is very hard for people as they end an affair. Could you?
It is. I think.
Yeah.
I think
elaborate on it. I know you start by saying the message must be absolutely clear.
Well, here's the problem is that from the point of the view of the person, and I have a lot of empathy for the person who has had an affair.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I don't endorse affairs. I don't think they're good for marriage. I'm not pleased, you know, if this is a choice somebody makes. But I also understand it's not an easy choice often to have an affair. And it's a difficult decision to do that. It's difficult, I know, to break it off. But what often happens is the person who the third person involved it's difficult to say goodbye to that person if you're the one who's married, because you kind of feel like that person hasn't done anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
A man and a wife who are married, assuming
yeah.
that man now has a third person, a woman, involved, and
mm-hmm.
his wife says, you have to cut her off.
Mm-hmm.
His thought is, well, I can't be rude to her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she didn't do anything. I can't be mean. I can't just cut her off. That's rude. I should meet her over coffee and tell her
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
I should say something like, it's not a good idea for us to get together, as opposed to saying, I can never see you again. After all, she never did anything to hurt me. And quite the contrary, she did quite a lot to please me.
So, yes, and you go on in your book to say that any form of communication can be used. Do you think that an in-person meeting might produce some red flags?
I'm not a big supporter. I understand, again, why people are interested in that, because it feels after you've had this relationship and affair with someone, sending them an email or a text just doesn't seem right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think meeting with them in person just continues the dialogue.
Right.
Just gives the message that we'll sort this out. Let's just agree to part and let's try to set things up for ourselves for a future. It's something we're going to work on together.
Mm-hmm.
And my view is no.
Mm-hmm.
You and the person you've had an affair with don't work on anything together.
Mm-hmm.
You individually make the decision this affair has ended.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you make it crystal clear. And that's, I think, the important thing about communicating it. And I often suggest that if you send an email, that you do it with your spouse. You know, there's this thing that kids have when they're texting. It says POS, which means parent over the shoulder. You know, we should do the same thing with
uh-huh.
SOS. So, you know, you'd be aware my spouse is with me, watching me, and even say that in the text message. My spouse is with me as I'm sending this.
That makes it really real and
yes.
sincere. I mean, you do say your mate, when possible, should be witness to the breakup. And, of course, that will give the mate some reassurance, I think, that
I hope, if you do it right.
That
I
you're
mean,
sincere.
Exactly. You have
mm-hmm.
to be both sincere and clear, and that's the
mm-hmm.
thing. And
sincere
so
and clear,
if your spouse
yes.
says to you, you were not clear, then instead
mm-hmm.
of saying, well, I certainly was, you say, okay, what can I do to make it clearer? I mean, I mm-hmm. need to know that my spouse thinks it was crystal clear. Now, what's going to happen is
mm-hmm.
that third party is still going to try to contact you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then what often happens is the spouse, the affected spouse, is upset by that. Well, what did you say in the message? Why did you not say it clearly enough? And that really can't be the other spouse's fault. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's human nature for that flame addiction to continue on both sides of the equation. So that's why I think it's always easier to go back and say, look, here's the email that I sent, you and I sent together, it was clear. And even if it's over the phone, if you're going to do it over the phone, have it written down in advance what you're planning on saying, so that there's no doubt that you leave anything, you know, that you didn't leave anything out that can make it clear that the affair has to end.
And actually having a script in front of you can eliminate some of the nervousness, plus it's additional evidence to your mate that
yeah.
That you're doing this.
Exactly.
For people that didn't hear our program on April 22nd, could you briefly go over flame addiction? You just mentioned it, and then we'll come back to some other steps to ending an affair. And making
flame addiction is my mm-hmm. answer to what people describe as sex addiction. They'll say, well, you
right.
know, this person had an affair because they're a sex addict. In most cases, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
In
mm-hmm.
most cases, there's something about that other person
mm-hmm.
that's not just sexually related. And so flame addiction reflects that whole chemical cascade that happens in your head
mm-hmm.
where people have a drive, a passion, like an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to let go. And when you understand that, I think you'll have compassion for your spouse when you say, well, you are supposed to not see that person or not speak to them, but you got a text message the day after we spoke. Therefore, you must not care about me.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's hard to break from an addiction, but, you know, when two people work together, it's an easier process. And when you know the steps that can help you move past it, then you're more in control of your own life. I don't think people appreciate when they're having an affair how out of control they are in their lives.
I think that's such a good point, and we do have brain chemistry involved with some of this. We know that, for instance, vasopressin is released during sex, and it's probably released in other intimate situations as well. And I think that one solution, and I've mentioned this to some of my couples where an affair is a big part of what we're dealing with, a past affair, that, mm-hmm. That they, commit to creating touch points during the day and making five small intimate gestures, a hug, a kiss, an email, or a text, for instance, throughout the day, and then she can respond in her own way. And this can ignite the vasopressin bonding centers in the brain, well, maybe even 10 times a day. So this can increase the bond between the couple.
To that, I agree that, mm-hmm. that continuing to introduce yourself to the sense that we're a couple, we're connected, we are a team, increases that sense of bonding
mm-hmm.
that you're talking about with the vasopressin as well as the oxytocin.
Mm-hmm.
And also to that, to, you know, also a little bit of excitement. You know, I can't wait to see you. I have a surprise for you.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so also you can build up the dopamine at the same time. Keep yourself and your partner interested
mm-hmm.
in each other
mm-hmm.
during the course of your relationship in general, but also your recovery from infidelity.
Yes. And a big part of keeping interest is, are some of these surprises. Oh, I have a surprise for you later. And
mm-hmm.
surprises, of course, are romantic. But there's lots of work to be done.
Wait a minute, hold on a second. Just you know,
yeah.
you know probably well enough that the low romance partner, which in many cases is the woman,
right.
that's not that. The idea that, honey, I have a surprise for you later on, come in the room and I have my pants down.
Yeah, no, I don't mean that kind of surprise.
They're like, oh, great, this is wonderful. You know, you have to make sure that that's not the surprise unless that's the surprise your partner wants.
Yeah, I'm talking much more romantic, but that's part of the rebuilding, and that's not our focus at this moment, although we're going to get into some guidelines for recovery. But first, some principles of apology. You know, this is very hard for people, and you, in your book, you have five principles, and I'd like you to elaborate on them. And
absolutely.
Yeah, good. So we've got genuine, acknowledge the other's pain, ask for forgiveness, offer retribution, and forgive yourself. Yeah. So what about being genuine in your apology?
Well, I think often something has happened, and maybe it's cultural and it's been happening over the last few centuries, but certainly in my lifetime it seems to me that the concept of apology has become very complicated and sometimes almost insulting, you know, when you hear celebrities, maybe because, you know, the media is just day by minute by minute, but, you know, you hear celebrities say things like, well, I'm sorry if she was upset with what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I'm sorry that these things happened.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't really, doesn't really take, it doesn't take accountability for what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, when I say be genuine, I mean that you not only have to kind of express in your own words what it is that you've done, but you have to also accept responsibility for it. So to say something like, I'm really sorry I had an affair. It was because I drank too much. Or I'm sorry that this happened, but, you know, if you had been more attentive to me sexually, it never would have gotten to this point. Those aren't apologies. I'm just
That's
saying
right.
the
they're,
word I'm
they're
sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, for instance, 40% of women who cheat say that they wanted more emotional attention. So they're just giving excuses. They're not really apologizing.
Well, it's a form of an apology, but it's not the apology your partner needs. And unless you
yeah.
give the kind of apology your partner needs, you are going to have a very disgruntled partner, and you're not going to be able to move past it, which is why when I hear from so many people who've read my book, so many of them turn to this particular chapter. And what's interesting for me about the whole forgiveness issue is several years ago I was giving lectures at the American Psychiatric Association, a half-day-long seminar on infidelity, and I had about one slide for forgiveness. You know, it was basically, you know, forgive, and because if you don't forgive, you'll never be able to move on, and you know, and there's, but I really don't think I appreciated how complicated the process of asking forgiveness and granting forgiveness is. So moving on to those other steps, the other is to acknowledge the other person's pain. So it's not enough to say, I'm sorry for the affair, but it's I'm sorry for the affair and the effect it had on you. And you need to really be clear on what those effects were. And if you can't spontaneously generate all the effects, just ask your partner. I want to know all the ways it hurt you because I want to know all the ways in which you deserve an apology. So the second thing is to acknowledge the other person's pain. And then once you've been genuine in your apology, you've recognized their pain, the next step is to ask for forgiveness. Now, you can't negotiate it. It can't be like, well, I won't ever complain about you watching football again if you just forgive me.
That kind of negotiation.
Or you can try to sweet talk it. Oh, come on, honey. You know, I never do anything like that again. Just tell me you'll forgive me. And you can't demand it. You know, I've done everything you've asked. You must forgive me now. I can't do anything more. It has to sometimes come in time. So you have to ask. Just because you've asked doesn't mean your spouse has to grant it to you.
Yes, and the spouse who has been the victim of the affair, my experience is it often takes a very long time before that spouse begins to trust again. And
that's
so in
right.
the meantime, the person who's had the affair has to be absolutely transparent and consistent with behaviors. And you write something that's so true, asking for forgiveness is an act of humility and vulnerability on your part. It's an inside, so that makes it a real inside job.
Well, and the idea that while there's vulnerability, it doesn't mean just because you've made yourself vulnerable that your partner is going to make you feel comfortable again. Your partner may leave you hanging. And, you know, frankly, that's a consequence of your decisions. And I talk later on about why it is that it's not easy for a partner to forgive, and I include things like they may still be angry. They may be seeking some form of atonement. I mean, you just haven't groveled enough. They believe they'll be a chimp. A chump. You know, that somehow you're going to make a fool of me again. You know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So if I grant forgiveness, that may just open up the Pandora's box for you doing it again. And also some people are afraid if I forgive you, it's like you did nothing wrong. So the law, if I don't give you that forgiveness, you'll still feel bad about it.
You go on to step four, offer retribution. And you give a very good quote. What, maybe this is somebody who wrote into your website. I know I can never undo what I did, but here's what I plan to do going forward.
I think that's the message there, and that again resonates with my readers, and many of them will say, you know, I'm so glad you put that in there because you know, I want something from my partner now. You know, I want some paper, and some. While I write in here, particularly, it doesn't have to be, you know, a gift. You know, it can be other signs of, you know, commitment to the marriage, maybe going to a marriage seminar, maybe deciding to attend church regularly. It could be lots of things, but for some people, they want a gift. Mm-hmm. All right, you gave her this much, you know, you gave her a present for Christmas, and I got squat. I want a present.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, again, it's perfectly legitimate for your partner to want some type of restitution.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a typo in the book, I should say, by the way. I write retribution. I mean restitution. So
now I better understand. Okay.
When the second and third editions come out, we'll say restitution.
Okay.
But unfortunately, it now says give retribution. So,
yeah, I was a little confused by that, but of course, as I continued to read, kind of got the idea.
Yeah. It was one of my attentive listeners at a lecture, and they're like, as I'm showing a slide, and I go, well, I'm sure I didn't write that in the book. And then I look, and I said, oh, my God. And my wonderful copyright editors had missed it. So, and then the last part is...
That's all right. Nobody's perfect, right?
That's what this book is all about.
Yes.
And the last part is just to forgive yourself. Because I've had people that have just beaten themselves up. Their partner says, hey, it's okay. We can move on. No, I just can't let go of it. And
mm-hmm.
you need to be in a strong position if you're going to move forward in this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Both of you need to feel strength and power and purchase and drive. You need to be part of a team, and you can't do it if you're just wallowing in pity.
In pity and just beating up on yourself
endlessly
with guilt and shame, and then that does prevent any forward momentum.
And that's the idea, is to keep the momentum moving forward.
Yes. And in general, don't you agree, Dr. Scott, that lots of people have trouble forgiving themselves, especially if they have, now we're moving a little bit away from your book, but especially if they have a family of origin that's extremely dysfunctional. And
it's interesting because I do a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right.
And one of the things that I've learned in that is that people are really their harshest coaches and critics.
That you would
never hire a tennis coach, or you
mm-hmm.
would never allow a kid to coach somebody to coach your kid's baseball team that had the kind of attitude you often have toward yourself,
mm-hmm.
which is
mm-hmm.
to be negative, put yourself down, not see the bright side, and you really do have to let go of that critical spouse or that critical inner voice, which does sometimes come from having grown up in a household where you weren't getting the kind of nurturance and support that your parents ought to have given you. But you can't do much about that now.
No, but where you actually had a very critical parent. So if we look at transactional analysis, was mm-hmm. that Eric Byrne so many years ago?
It was.
Yeah, so you've got the parent and the adult and the child ego states. And as I understand it, the critical parent ego state is the hardest one to get rid of. And so some people who want to be in their playful child state will drink or do some other drug to put the critical parent to sleep so the child can come out to play.
Mm.
And as I understand it, the critical parent is the hardest ego state to deal with because it's often so kind of integrated from one's family of origin.
An example where, mm-hmm. when you actually have something to truly be critical of. I mean, that's
mm-hmm.
There's no sugarcoating it. Having an affair is a giant breach
of
trust, and
mm-hmm.
you know, you've made a promise to somebody who is part of your life to live a life together
mm-hmm.
Forever, and that's a big, you shouldn't forgive yourself easily for that, but you should ultimately.
Because then you can move forward,
yes.
and we're going to talk about how you do that, the guidelines for recovery, as we go on here. You're right. Forgiveness doesn't come easily. You're still angry. Talk about the remnants of anger that often linger around, and it's another huge stumbling block for people.
Well, I think the issue there is that you know, because you've been hurt,
mm-hmm.
and the person that did the damage to you was supposed to be your biggest ally,
mm-hmm.
it magnifies the sense of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it stirs up a whole bunch of feelings about being lied to, about being disrespected.
Mm-hmm.
And so people often want to hold on to the rage because it's something they can identify. They can, it's theirs.
Mm-hmm.
You may have had this person, you had an affair with, you may have had this, you may be, but I have my rage, you know, and I
right.
can hold on to it.
Mm-hmm.
And giving up the rage, may be, you know, it may not be, it may feel like too big of a step.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, this is an issue of one of my favorite quotes is from Nelson Mandela.
Yes, I was just looking at that.
That
yes.
I write in this book.
Yeah.
Where he writes, resentment is like a glass of poison that a man drinks, then he sits down and waits for his enemy to die.
Isn't that brilliant? And so accurate.
Yeah. So you go ahead, you hold on to that rage, but it's not going to hurt anyone but you.
Oh, haven't you seen that so often in your patients?
I do, and it's disheartening for me, but I think as mm-hmm. clinicians, as therapists, we can really help mm-hmm. people with that. Mm-hmm. It's the people that aren't coming to my office that I
yes.
really worry about.
Of course. Of course. And I do, too. I do, too. So we... But... People that are seeking help and really wanting to make changes, and change is hard, particularly if you're an older person. I find in general my patients who are in their late 30s or early, late 20s, let's say, or 30s, have a little easier time changing than if they're in their 50s or 60s, where things are more sort of integrated, even if it is in a dysfunctional way, but it's more part of the fabric of their lives.
Yeah, you've developed a habit for that
mm-hmm.
many more years,
mm-hmm.
and it's often more ingrained, and sometimes people can learn new ways to manage their emotions and move
mm-hmm.
forward, but when they're stressed, people
mm-hmm.
do tend to fall back on their tried and true ways, even though ultimately they don't tend to work very well for them.
No. And so often they are reflective of some models they had in their families of origin. And
well, that's
yeah.
something I think that you can't help in any relationship.
Right.
You're going to bring in
yes.
those models. But it puzzles me often
uh-huh.
that somebody who is, as you say, in their 50s or 60s is still
mm-hmm.
stuck with the models of when they were 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you have the right to, and I would even argue the obligation, to break away from the models that you found so disruptive and upsetting for you. You can make your own models.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
And I really try to encourage people to do that. And that's one of the reasons, you know, we'll talk in a little bit about the one tip to help people you know, move forward in their marriage, but I think much of it has to do with having the flexibility of being aware of what your partner needs, and
mm-hmm.
not being so stuck in getting your own needs met that you can't see it.
So I would guess that if you've got one person who's pretty narcissistic and feeling entitled
mm-hmm.
and lacking empathy, that's going to be huge in trying to come to some sort of resolution.
Yeah. Well,
mm-hmm.
one of the problems here is that when couples are stressed,
mm-hmm.
Very often, and I wonder if your listeners can resonate with this, but very
mm-hmm.
often, the woman in the partnership will end up reverting to a level of emotional interaction, which looks very much like borderline personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And the man
mm-hmm.
will revert to a level of interaction which looks very much like narcissistic personality disorder.
Oh, that's fascinating, Scott. Yeah.
So I can't tell you all the times that I treat somebody who has been seeing an individual therapist.
Mm-hmm.
They're now in a troubled marriage.
Mm-hmm.
The woman is describing to the husband, to the therapist, the nature of her husband's interactions, and that therapist, typically
mm-hmm.
without ever seeing the husband, says, sounds like your husband has narcissistic personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And the reverse, of course, that when the man is complaining to his therapist about all the things his wife is doing in the course of this potential divorce or potential affair, that therapist goes, that sounds like she's got borderline personality disorder. So I don't even know that it's worthwhile you and me talking about narcissistic personality disorder.
No,
narcissistic
I just interjected
because,
that. It's,
yeah, because it does. It invites people to label their partner's behaviors as an illness and gets them away from the ability to recover. Because once you say to yourself, oh, well, I have a severely pathological spouse, therefore I would never want to go back to being with him or her. You know, you've kind of lost the incentive to working toward recovering from infidelity.
Well, that's a brilliant point and a very good one. And we need to go to a break. And when we come back, we will go to guidelines for recovery that do not include labeling people. Yes. But I do like how, as a therapist myself, I really like how you structured that or explained that. So thank you for that. So when we come back, guidelines for recovery, Dr. Scott Holtzman, who is a psychiatrist, the secrets of surviving infidelity. Please stay with us. And we'll be right back. We're back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And we're talking with Dr. Scott Holtzman about the secrets of surviving infidelity, where lust perhaps has gotten in the way of love, and an affair has happened. But you say with great confidence, Dr. Scott, that affairs are treatable. Infidelity is treatable, and trust can be rebuilt. So we want to talk about the guidelines for recovery. And at the top of your list, what would you say is there?
Well, I think that before moving forward with any type of rebuilding, I'd say the top of my list would be the rebuilding of trust.
Yeah.
The establishment of trust.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think that couples are ready to move forward until a significant amount of trust can be reinstated. Now, I think it can be argued that you may not ever trust your spouse 100%. But I don't think you have to trust your spouse 100% to move forward. I just think you have to trust your spouse enough to know that all the things are in place, because you can't predict the future. I mean, nobody marries with the intent of having an affair. And very few people make the promise of marriage with the expectation that they're going to leave the marriage to find relationships elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But even from the first day you exchange your wedding rings, perhaps there's a level of vigilance that one partner ought to have. Matter of fact, both partners ought to have that vigilance.
Mm-hmm.
I ought to be vigilant not only for what my spouse might do, but I ought to be vigilant about my own behavior and these seemingly innocent things that might end up leading to affairs. So, so I think that the most important step there is the rebuilding of trust, and then from there, you have to make the decision. You have to make the decision about whether you can decide to move forward and rebuild the marriage.
And you write that knowing what circumstances can lead to an affair is your best protection against having affairs. And when I'm counseling couples with these issues, I'll say, you know, there are some ways that you can avoid becoming a cheater. You can If they're worried about it, or if somebody's transgressed and they're backing up and looking at it. So you need to address it. You need, maybe you need a confidence boost. So ask your partner for one. You know, sing each other's praises. And if you can talk about that openly, that's kind of intimate. That's a sort of an intimacy. And then sometimes finding new friends is important, don't you think? Because some people hang around with cheaters.
That's right. And research does show that if you're spending time with people that engage in infidelity, you're more likely to engage in it yourself because it becomes more socially appropriate. So finding new friends, and here's the big asterisk after that, or footnote, is that these friends are you know, these friends should be friends of the family. These should be, it doesn't mean, you know, if my wife is and I can't enjoy watching certain types of movies together, it doesn't mean I should find a new female friend to go watch movies with.
Right.
It means finding new friends for us to associate with together. If I'm heterosexual, to find some same-sex friends to spend time with, rather than setting myself up to be in an experience where I'm going to be at risk for having an affair. And one of the things that I write about in the book, we didn't talk about it last week, but I talk about having a see-through marriage.
And so that transparency.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that that particularly after an affair happens, that you need to be able to have access to your partner's email, your partner's snail mail, your partner's bank accounts, their Facebook page. And, you know, in these days, people get very, well, hold on a second. I mean, I know we're married. I know we share sexual fluids and everything, but I'm not going to share my password. You know, people get very protective about that. But I think the fact of the matter is that this is where infidelity happens these days, with text messages and emails and instant messages. And if you believe that you can have had an affair, but still try to argue that your partner has no right to read your cell phone text messages, you are wrong. Mm-hmm. This is really critical toward establishing, because my wife can read all of mine and I can read all of hers.
Yes.
What do we have to hide from each other?
Exactly.
And if you're at the point where you have something to hide, you have to ask yourself, is this a possible relationship that could be leading to an affair?
Yeah, and it's such an important part of rebuilding the trust, which may actually take years. I mean, I think a lot of men in particular don't consider the fallout when they engage in an affair, because a lot of women experience symptoms similar to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
For
sure.
Years afterwards, they may have flashbacks, anxiety, depression. And
yeah,
so the guy needs to think, do I really want to take this on?
Well, they're not thinking.
Right.
This is what that flame addiction is all about. They're really not.
Right.
They're not saying that. Somehow you can rationalize it and say, well, I'm having an affair, but my wife won't be hurt because she'll never know. I'm having an affair, but, you know, my husband deserves it because he doesn't say two words to me. And you can rationalize doing it without saying, I'm having an affair, and the person that I've promised my life to, that I've shared children with, and that depends on me for her sanity and stability over the course of the next half a century, is going to be horrified by this. That's not what goes through people's minds, but it ought to be.
Mm.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. It has to also, in terms of fixing this thing and make the recovery, perhaps changing expectations, because fixing the relationship you're currently unsatisfied with will probably take a lot of time and time together.
I like what you say about expectations, because one of my chapters in this book is called What to Expect When You're Expecting a Happy Marriage. And that really does deal with the fact that we have very high and often unrealistic expectations of what marriage is going to bring us.
Mm-hmm.
And in part because of the culture, the Hollywood culture and the romantic culture, So folks say, yeah, I know marriage is a lot of work, but the positives of marriage, you know, I compare marriage to a baseball game. And I'm not a big fan of baseball, but my understanding of baseball is a lot of times you're sitting there in the bleachers and nothing is happening.
Right.
It's a pitch, a foul, a pitch, a foul, a pitch, a foul. Somebody's on first, they're out. Somebody's in first again, they're out. And then they switch.
Yes.
But then all of a sudden, boom, something happens.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be there for the whole game to appreciate the joy of that. And I think that's really what happens in marriage a lot, is that a lot of times nothing happens.
Yeah.
Or it's frustrating or it's annoying, and then boom, you know, something tremendous happens.
Right.
So you've got to be in that marriage all the way. But I think people get very, people often end up leaving marriages and walking away at times when they're feeling like the love feelings have waned. And however, those things tend to go in cycles. And I do believe the people that stay married are ones that are the same ones that walked away from marriage, but they decided to stay in.
Mm-hmm.
And then years
mm-hmm.
later, they don't even remember the time they wanted to leave marriage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting, yes. Oh, you must have a lot of satisfaction for with the couples that you've seen where they have stayed, and then you can see how they rebuild and get happier.
It's just a matter of looking at some of the expectations. So in the book,
right.
I talk about whether you're ready to rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to kind of go over 5 points that I make. If you've
yes.
been the victim of an affair, you have to ask yourself if you're able to spend more than a few minutes
mm-hmm.
at a time without thinking about the affair,
mm-hmm.
whether your partner has acknowledged the role that he or she's played in the affair and
yes.
and that has expressed accountability, and if you're satisfied with that, if you can make a conscious decision not to allow your emotions to hijack you. I mean, if
mm-hmm.
you can kind of say, all right, I know I have a lot of emotional feelings, that's normal, but I cannot let them rule my life.
Mm-hmm.
If you mm-hmm. have developed enough trust, and we were talking about this before, that you can feel safe even though about moving forward, even though it may not be 100%. And now here's the other thing, is that in order to move forward, you have to acknowledge that even though the marriage was not that the affair was not your choice,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
there are still changes that you can make to improve the marriage. I mean, because everybody can find some things to do to improve the marriage. And if those things are in place, then I do think that you're ready to move on and work toward rebuilding a better marriage.
I think one of the things that can be done that often makes a huge difference is when you have mismatched desire, it's often the woman with a lower sexual desire.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
if she can kind of say, okay, I may not feel a whole lot of desire. I may need some arousal before the desire kicks in, but I'm just going to do it.
Yes.
And I'm going to give my mate a gift. Because I think in good marriages, people give their spouses what they want, even if they don't always want the same thing.
Are you jumping ahead to building a better marriage in my one word of advice for people? My
oh,
one
no,
let's, sentence.
No, no, I didn't mean to.
You just stole my thunder.
Oh dear, I didn't intend to because I really want to hear, Scott. I really want to hear the one rule to a happy
right.
marriage.
I think
and we are, you know, we've got a little more than 10 minutes for the program. But what is that one rule? Let's talk
yeah.
about it.
You nailed it. The bottom line there is you need to figure out what your spouse would like from you
yeah.
and do more of what your spouse likes and less of what your spouse doesn't like.
Yeah. Why don't you repeat that one more time? Because I want our listeners to really take this in. You know, it's also part of the golden rule, isn't it?
Well, no.
I mean, somewhat.
The golden rule says do what you would want done for you.
Oh, that's true.
Do
this is a little different.
Figure out
what your spouse wants.
That's right. This is the platinum rule. Do
the
unto others as
platinum rule. Oh, yeah, good.
As they would be done upon. Not
yeah.
do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. So I might say, well, I would want someone to take me to a baseball game, so I'm going to take my wife to a baseball game.
Mm.
Well, that's the golden rule. Do for other people as you would want them to do for you. But the platinum rule says figure out what they want. Mm-hmm. For instance, I don't like greeting cards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, it's a waste of $4.99.
They are expensive these days, aren't they?
And, you know, you can't even you can't buy the 91-cent ones anymore because there's only one version of each, and there's only so many anniversaries you can send the same card. So, you know, it doesn't do much for me. So,
yeah.
But what I understand is that my wife likes cards.
Mm.
You know, I'll get her a, you know, I haven't actually done this, but I can imagine if I got her a brand new car and put a giant card on it, she'd run over and open the card first.
Of course.
Because she likes the card.
Uh-huh.
And then she'd say thank you for the car, and then she'd want to know why I got this color and not another color.
Right. That sounds like something I would do.
But, yeah, so what I want to do is I want to understand what it is that my partner needs. And in this case, she likes cards. So I will, you know, we've been married 25 years. I will admit that sometimes whole months go by without my sending her cards.
Mm-hmm.
But I make more of an effort to send her cards in general than I would if I weren't married to her. Because I know she likes it. And it's going to make her happy. And that's kind of figure out what your partner needs. Do more of those things and less of the things that she doesn't like. So if at the same time she doesn't like me to leave the dirty dishes in the sink, or she doesn't like me to leave the toilet seat up, I should make an effort to put the toilet seat down and put the dishes in the dishwasher.
Right, right. Boy, I think she's a pretty lucky lady.
Well, you'll have to ask her. Maybe I'm boosting the my credibility here a bit.
No, I think you're entitled because you're very conscious about these things. And
I am, and you do, that's exactly the point. You do have to be conscious about it. What's the purpose of this particular interaction right now? I mean, if I come home if a person comes home and sees some clothes on the floor, what's the purpose in saying to your partner, why are there clothes on the floor?
Mm-hmm.
Or the floor is a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Or why didn't you get to cleaning up? I mean, if you're conscious about it,
you'll
say, well, I want to have a lifetime relationship with this person, so I want to have some type of interaction that is going to make this person feel better about me, not make this person feel like they're being criticized or put down or that I'm superior to them. So that's that consciousness you talk about, and I love that phrase. Thanks for throwing it in here.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, I think in general, the process of psychotherapy is to become more conscious about one's difficulties. I have a metaphor where you probably have heard of this because it's been around a while, where you're walking down the road and there's a hole in the road, and that represents a whole lot of problems in your life. And you keep walking down the road and falling in the same hole, and then you get some counseling and you begin to walk around the hole. And then you get some more and you're more and more conscious and you can identify your dysfunctional behaviors and thoughts and, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, right? So then finally, lo and behold, you walk down a different road altogether, a different road with no hole in it. And what a relief.
Well, there's that. Psychotherapy often is a very long process.
Yes, it is. I didn't mean to suggest that it wasn't.
And I think recovery from difficult times requires a lot of introspection, and a lot of personal building, a lot of understanding why it was, for instance, that you had an affair. And I think also people need to kind of take some accountability in what the quality of the relationship is and move forward to improving it. And couples therapy couples education involves a lot of really teaching people the skills to master those areas, because most people have an idealized view of what marriage is.
Yeah.
And they don't appreciate that even happily married couples argue. As a matter of fact, studies suggest that they argue just as much as unhappily married couples.
Yeah, the Gottman studies show that. It's the ratio of the positive interactions versus the negative, and if in the conflict, if they can, right?
Fight. And the ability to repair.
And
the avoidance of certain types of certain types of kind of automatic, what he calls the four horsemen of the apocalypse, these automatic things that tend to destroy people. But just,
criticism, contempt.
Stonewalling and defensiveness.
Stonewalling and defensiveness. Oh, stonewalling comes last.
Exactly.
In the Gottman model, and he makes a very interesting point that it's often the man who stonewalls, that men actually with anger literally get hotter under the collar.
Yes.
And they're afraid that they might lash out. This is a nonviolent man, but he doesn't want that to happen, so he goes into his man cave and stonewalls and tries to calm himself down.
Yeah, he may go out and say, I got to take a drive. He may go for a walk. He may just go to the other room. And often what will happen when people haven't learned about this is, you know, sticking with the same scenario, the woman will stand in front of him and say, you're not leaving. We're not done discussing this.
Mm.
And I think partners have to have permission. I understand stonewalling is not a good idea, but if you're so enraged, if you're so upset that you can't have a rational conversation, then the best thing is to step away. But you have to step away with the promise of returning back to the table.
Absolutely. Step away and calm down. You write in your book, this is such a great book, I really encourage our listeners to get this book, and I'll write how they can with the websites and all that in my summary of the show. But you write some gender-specific tips for improving communication, and I really like this for men. Stand still during conversation.
Yeah.
Be present in the room physically and mentally. Some movement will relax you, but it'll make her more tense.
That's right. That's right. You guys are more prone to ADD. You know, if they fidget, they can actually sometimes focus better. The problem is she's not interpreting it that way.
Exactly.
So you have to train yourself to sit still, to make eye contact if possible. I know it's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You have to use your words if you're a man and say things like, oh, really? Okay, I understand. Because we tend to be sometimes very good listeners, but not very good at letting somebody know they're being listened to. And that's what I try to help men understand.
And you write, if she wants you to help fix something, help fix it, but do that only after you listen. Men tend to just jump in because men are fixers. I mean, generalizing, of course.
Right.
They'll just want to fix it, and maybe she really needs you to listen to her.
That's right. That's right. So when you jump up with a solution as a guy, you think you're offering a great gift to your wife because you now have offered a solution to the problem she's complaining about, and she says, you are not listening to me.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking, well, not only am I listening, but I've come up with a solution. How could I prove it to you better? And the point is she doesn't want you to fix it. She just wants to be able to have you understand what she's experiencing. But I also give gender-specific advice to women, too, right?
Yeah, and one of the best points that I like is ask for what you need. Sometimes saying, I don't want you to solve anything. I just want you to listen. Please listen to me.
Right. Yeah, and sometimes I tell women you even have to be more specific. You have to say, I want you to listen to me, and about every minute or so I want you to nod your head and say yes.
You know, which indicates...
In other words, help him succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the most common things that men will say is, she keeps telling me what I have to do, and then I never get it right. And then I feel like I can't get anything right. So help him get it right.
Help him get it right. That's a really important point, because a lot of men feel so frustrated. Everything I try, I'm not doing it right. And then they'll throw up their hands and maybe just go have the affair because they're so...
Because men want to, you know, as we said before, they want to fix it. They want to kind of swoop in as your Superman and kind of and make your life better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine if every time that Superman swooped up with Lois Lane, she went, "Ow, you're so rude, you're so insensitive." I mean, after a while, he'll stop swooping her up.
But you do make, speaking of swooping, you make another point for women, and I really agree with this, move, going on walks or riding in a car. So that'll help the action-oriented brain for the man
and
reduce his anxiety.
I just read a study yesterday that said that engaging in physical activities
Right.
Actually helps you improve problem solving. You can come up with more creative solutions of things if you're moving versus sitting still.
Yeah.
So
more creative.
Hot off the press study. Yeah?
Yep. I believe I read some version of that too. And sometimes couples that have a lot of trouble discussing a particular topic, whatever it is, can do it better on a walk.
That's right. That's right.
Or in a long car ride.
That's right. It's comfortable for a woman to sit and stare at another woman, you know, and have that piercing eye contact and really bond while they're talking. If you sit in that piercing eye contact with a guy, he's not even going to be able to hear what you're saying. He's going to start feeling uncomfortable, his eyes shifting back and forth, because he's just not used to sustaining eye contact like that.
Oh, Dr. Scott, we have come to the end of the program, and I'm hoping that perhaps I can entice you back in 6 months or something like that, because you have so much to say, and one of the...
I hope I have something new 6 months from now to say.
Aren't you going to write another book? You've already written four, haven't you?
I have written four, yes.
Yeah.
And the first was The Secrets of Happily Married Men, then The Secrets of Happily Married Women.
Yeah.
And the third was The Secrets of Happy Families. And this, of course, is The Secrets of Surviving Infidelity.
Yeah.
And I'd be thrilled to come back on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Scott. You're just always such a joy to talk to you. Thank you.
And
it's made my birthday that much better because I've been able to interview you.
I totally neglected your birthday.
It's all right. I dropped you a major hint. Women are supposed to do that.
Exactly. Now I feel awful. Okay, just indulge me for just a second here. Ready?
Well, that is about the first harmonica birthday song I've ever had, and I love it. Thank you for that. I didn't know you were musical on top of everything else. That's very impressive.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, Scott, and we'll be in touch. And thank you, listeners, for listening. Bye-bye, everybody.